This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. Filling in for John O'Brien, I'm Kendra Hanna. This episode of Speakers Forum centers around three very different experiences of childhood sexual abuse. However, all three guests consider the responsibility of caregivers to prevent abuse and the difficulty of demanding justice decades after the crime. Joan Knuckles Wilson is a lawyer and writer based in Anchorage, Alaska. Her 2021 memoir, The Book of Timothy, My Brother, the Devil, and Me, recounts her attempt to find justice for her brother, Tim Knuckles. Tim was abused by a Catholic priest during their childhood in Chicago. Joan writes about their shared childhood, her life in Anchorage, and finally, her travels to confront her brother's abuser in Rome. Tim Knuckles is a financial advisor based in Chicago. He's worked in finance for over 30 years. He decided to come forward with his story after reading about similar sexual abuse by Catholic priests in an exposé reported by the Boston Globe. Erica Schickel is an author, memoirist, and voice actor. Her 2021 memoir, The Big Hurt, explores her experiences as a young girl coming of age in the 70s and 80s. Raised by two writers, she was sent to an East Coast boarding school after her parents' divorce. There, she started a relationship with a predatory teacher. That abuse ended with Schickel being punished and expelled from her preparatory high school. The way our culture confronts sexual abuse and AIDS survivors has gained increased media attention in recent years. But prevention and treatment measures are still far from adequate. According to the Centers for Disease Control, quote, child sexual abuse is a significant but preventable public health problem. Many children wait to report or never report child sexual abuse. About 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 13 boys experience child sexual abuse at some point in childhood. 91% of child sexual abuse is perpetrated by someone the child or child's family knows, unquote. This program was presented on January 13, 2022 by the Elliott Bay Book Company. Please note, this episode contains discussion of sexual abuse in unedited language of an adult nature.
I still remember, as if it was yesterday, the first day I walked into Elliott Bay Book Company, and in Seattle, and it felt like coming home. I'm like you, Erica, probably find great comfort in the presence of books. But I just want to say that introduction to the very same thing for me felt like coming home. As a resident of Anchorage, we kind of consider ourselves Seattleites just a little bit. We travel through your city quite a bit to come home. My other connections, one of the opening scenes when Tim first told me what happened in his story, I was working at the Anchorage office of the Seattle-based firm Davis Wright Tremaine, where I started as a baby lawyer and met some wonderful people that are mentors and also discussed in that book. I think one of them may be on this call. She and I worked HIPAA law for a long time. And then I also saw the name of my co-counsel in the Hubbard Board dentist case, Eric Senta, who's another wonderful writer, hopefully telling that story. And last, the editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper, the Resurrection Banner, is attending. So that's my Seattle connection. Erica, do you have any stories to tell?
I have a bunch of Seattle connections. I mean, first of all, my people settled Seattle when began the first Methodist church and school in Seattle many years ago. But more recently, I actually began The Big Hurt in Seattle. When I got a fellowship at Hedgebrook, which is an amazing writing retreat for women on Whidbey Island. And that's where I met the wonderful local favorite, Claire Dieterer, who not only blurbed my book, but we really bonded on Whidbey Island, and she ended up being a real sounding board for me as I wrote this book. And I had two fellowships out there, I really owe them a big nod and a thank you. That's my Seattle.
Great. Well, I think I'll sign up for that for my next book. It sounds really good with her. went there twice. Well, thank you, audience. I think you're going to see some really interesting parallels between, I'm going to call it Tim's story and Erica's story. I'm a little bit of a fly on the wall, even though I'm impacted to some degree as well. But I'd like to start you back to the time that really allowed what happened to Tim and that happened to Erica, I think, propagate just the level of, did our parents really know what was happening to us? In order to make this a bit of a shorter story for you, I'm going to be jumping back and forth a little bit, and I hope I get the order right. But if you see me pause, I'm following numbers in my writing. But let me start here. What I fear the most today are a failure of words and the resulting inability to justify my choices. Will a future reader or fault finder think there is a critical disconnect between subject me and object, revenge for Tim? For if anyone were to think my brother was not worth what has amounted to struggle after struggle over 10 years of my life, I would have done Tim a great injustice. 10 times 10 years. That is his worth. So as you see, I've only just begun. My Tim was born breech on the last day of January 1966 during a cold spell that sunk Chicago temperatures to well below zero for 1 week straight. From what my mother told me, however, my relationship with Tim began long before his birth on those frigid days. When his hands and feet punctuated our mother's womb, she said she told me, her feeding child, he's reaching toward you, Joan Mary, his Irish twin. Once I finished drinking and my sucking sounds were replaced with rhythmic breath, she would remind me we rested together, my brother and me, in double-decker slumber. When Tim did finally come home from the hospital, I heard we shared a crib for afternoon naps and slept together head to toe. My hand instantly wrapped around the arch of his foot like an involuntary reflex. Nearly every time, Mom said. From his birth, my mother told Tim, "Be comforted, dear one. Your sister can't let you go." We lived then. When Tim was just 1.5 and I was pushing 3, I stood by the tire swing hanging low to the ground from a single Dutch elm on our Mead Avenue front lawn. There, Tim made his way through the tall grass that was in need of a cutting. With each movement, the blades engulfed his lower body. When he reached me, he grabbed onto my legs and tried to hang on. I bent down to lift him up, but fell on top of him instead. We rolled together on the lawn. When the translucent wisp of his hair tickled my nose, I let out a child's giggle. He smelled like a honey-made graham cracker and became my first memory. In 1969, our family moved to the suburbs of Chicago. Tim and I filled our days with constant patrols for salamanders and chameleons that lived in our basement window wells and any other place where floodplain waters in this new town built on top of a one-time cornfield still might gather. When we found our wiggling friends, we carried them to the ripple of a creek, which we insisted on calling the Big River, behind our home. On the way back for lunch or supper, we always stopped to feed carrots to the neighbor's horses. It was there, I told Tim, the first person ever, I love the country much more than the city. And he replied, I know, country mouse. I know. Was it just us? With 6 other siblings, that was impossible. Nonetheless, it's Tim who stands out in my memory, who was always by my side until he wasn't. Are you ready? Because I'm still not yet. In Tim's 13th and 14th birthdays, Ormiche's visits came with greater frequency. they must have been more difficult for Tim to predict. Because even if Dad were spending the night at the firehouse, Ormaché would still show up for dinner. He didn't have to ask. Ours was an open door. He was even welcome the 5 days before payday when grocery shopping was off limits, and Mom scavenged the cabinets for something nutritious to feed us. On one such night, when Dad must have been at the firehouse, JB sat in an armless chair upholstered in the yellow and brown checks of our country-themed kitchen. He leaned forward and rested his left elbow against our sunflower yellow countertop. Mom stood at the kitchen sink washing dishes in scalding hot water with palm olive soap, no gloves. She regularly looked out the window over the sink to the gangway between ours and the Ankoviak's house, but turned back whenever he spoke. "So Mary, I was wondering." I was her official dish dryer that night and turned toward him as well. Perhaps my recollection has been influenced by reality, for no one other than John Wayne Gacy, who at the time happened to live about 2 miles away, looked better to play the part of child predator than Ormaché did. In 1981, JB was 42 years old. He was of European stock, just shy of 6 feet tall, and I expect around 220 pounds. His black priestly garb slimmed him, but his stomach was soft. So were his hands, not a callus in sight. Despite that, his skin had the bronze color of a working man's. His relatively full head of dark brown hair was parted at the far left and swept over his wide forehead. His gold-tinted aviator eyeglasses cut his thick sideburns in two. The lemon-yellow kitchen curtains, even brighter than the countertop, reflected in those eyeglasses. He sat comfortably slumped in the shape of a letter C, and turned in such a way he could easily monitor any movements, perhaps to him, invitations, emanating from my brother's closed bedroom door just down the hall. I don't recall what he said next, but I have no doubt he spoke in his animated sing-song voice and that he spoke of God and he made my mother proud. At a certain point, after the dishes were dried, Mom would have noticed that Father's coffee cup was half empty and would have filled it with the decaf drip remaining in the percolator. Before sitting at the kitchen table to join him, I know she excused me. And before heading upstairs that day to finish my homework, I knew for sure I had to talk to Tim. Something about that April day had been bothering me, and I thought he might understand. I opened his door quickly after just one knock. I don't even think he said, "Come in." I noticed his lights were off, so I switched them back on. At their first flash, I saw Tim sitting on top of his comforter, but braced like he was ready to leap off it. He had the look of a scared snowshoe hare. He was dressed still in his Notre Dame High School junior varsity basketball shorts and jersey. Although he was still a couple years shy of his growth spurt, he was muscular. I was prone to challenge him to arm wrestles. I would always lose. "Whoa, calm down. It's just me, Timmy," I remember saying. I laughed a bit, and then I saw him sigh. Even though I could have caught him doing all manner of things that 13-year-old boys must do, he seemed relieved it was me. He gave a casual lift to his chin and motioned his hand for me to come farther inside. I'm not sure why, but I shut the door behind me. Relief again crossed his face. Tim put another pillow behind his back and sat up straight. He leaned against his helm-shaped headboard and the stormy ocean blue wall behind it. He raised his knees. White tube socks with yellow stripes rode halfway down his calves. Questioning my choice and uncertain of his interest, I stammered, "Sorry to bother you. I sounded a bit like a waitress trying to close a tab before the end of her shift. But I came here because I was wondering if you remember what today was. He gave a blank stare that said no. It was 8 years ago today, April 17th, that we left Crystal Lake and moved back to Chicago. 8 years to the day, huh? Yep. How do you remember things like that? He asked. He sounded interested. Did I tell him, name the date, Papa George's death, then Aunt Pat's? I record every time we lose someone. Because it was the day Cha went missing. This was a reference to my Siamese cat. He tilted his head, puzzled. It's not like we didn't find her, Joan. It was Tim who did. He heard her in the back of the moving van and brought her to me once we reached the city. I know, but it wasn't my choice to leave her behind. I tried to explain. Mom and Dad got tired of looking for her and we just had to go. And I added, it was my job to keep her safe. I was 7. He seemed resigned to help. Got it, Joan. But she was found and she's here, I bet, right on your bed. It all worked out fine. Next, he changed the subject. So, Tim asked in a voice I now recognize as pensive, is he gone yet? Nah, he's still in the kitchen talking to Ma. I think it'll be soon, though. I heard him say he had 6 a.m. mass tomorrow. Tim turned to his nightstand and rustled through his top drawer. Then do me a favor. Stay here a while, okay? He pulled out a deck of cards. I got an idea. To celebrate our 8th anniversary here and Cha being safe, let's say we play crazy eights. Only after that front door was deadbolted with Ormiche outside of it did our game finally end. These are the things I take stock of now. Recording what I've lost. When he was alone and ravaged, don't think we had it beat. When he thought no one was on his side, stand at the fence and rattle the lock gate. I wish I could have told him. Scream, and then scream louder. I'm here. I see you. And we will bring this to an end. Why I didn't. My only explanation is my hand slipped. That's the only reason I would ever let him go. Thank you.
Wow. That's a really beautiful and profound passage. I mean, I just want to get right to talking about your book. I feel a little sheepish to read, but
please do.
I chose something really short and I cut it down. So it's only about 5 minutes long. But you, I guess we've chosen sort of ground zero scenes from our books. And this is certainly the one from mine. And just to set it up, it's the spring of my senior year. You know, I have been sent to this boarding school and I sort of found myself over the course of those 4 years. I was sort of a success. I had gone from being a very sort of bad, messed up girl to being sort of a really good student and upstanding member of the community. These two teachers, Henry was the music teacher, his wife Elaine was my French teacher, and they were actually really good friends of mine prior to the assault, or if we're going to call it that. And so this was not my first rodeo as a girl in the 70s and 80s. Henry was waiting for me in the doorway of the dining hall after lunch. I was wondering if you'd like to go for a bike ride after classes. I'd love to. He laughed at my enthusiasm and I blushed. I met him outside the gatehouse and we pushed off down Water Street on our bikes, past the library and the golf course towards Highway 2. The day was bright and warm. We rode wordlessly down Green River Road. We had come out this way 3 weeks earlier with Eileen before the photo shoot. I didn't ask why she wasn't with us today. Eileen and I had ridden abreast that day, chatting and laughing while Henry quietly cycled behind us. The buds were just opening then, but now spring was fully upon us. The trees had leafed out and were full of grackles. The Green River, which was really a stream, meandered sweetly alongside the road, hemmed in by a dilapidated split rail fence. Wads of chickadees startled up from its banks and darted across the road in front of us. We rode slowly. I didn't want to do or say anything that might break the spell of this magical afternoon alone with Henry. All too soon, we reached the gas station at Five Corners, the halfway point of our 10-mile loop. Luckily, the second half of the ride was the toughest and the slowest. Cold Spring Road had a long, steep uphill grade, and we both stood on our pedals to pump. Spring seemed to turn to summer as we chuffed and sweated, and the roadside scenery, the Queen Anne's lace and buttercups, went slowly, slowly past. When we finally topped the hill, we pulled up alongside a fence to catch our breath. The splintery old rails held back a small herd of Holsteins that chewed, oblivious to the sweeping view of the valley below. When our breathing finally slowed, Henry broke the silence. "I am in torment, Erica." I looked at him, and even though his transition lenses had darkened way down, I could read trouble in his eyes. "What's wrong?" He looked at me beseechingly. "I haven't been able to eat. I can't sleep. I can't do anything but think about you." I held very still so as not to interrupt him. "I watch you in the dining hall. I see you on the path between classes, and every time my heart stops." I gripped the handlebars of my bike to steady myself. "Am I shocking you? Tell me to shut up." "No. I'm telling you that I'm in love with you." This wasn't what I expected. Had I heard him right? I never dreamed that my schoolgirl crush on my teacher would be answered. He was waiting for my next line, and I grappled for it. I had played this scene on stage. I knew my line was, "I love you too," but the words caught in my throat. Instead, I said, "But what about Eileen?" "Oh, Eileen is not who you think she is, nor is our relationship." "What do you mean?" "Erica, we're not actually married." He pulled off his bike glove and showed me his fancy wedding ring. "We had these made so we could work at Buxton as a couple. This ring is meaningless. Do you understand what I am saying? I'm saying I am free to love you, and I am deeply in love with you." As a child of divorce, I understood that marriage was simply an outfit that people wore until they grew out of it. But I never imagined that people would lie about being married in the first place. Henry pulled off his glasses, and there were his eyes, brimming with emotion. "Do you have any feelings for me?" My crush on him was still new. I had barely mapped its area. And now, suddenly, it was no longer a crush, but a reciprocated love? Did I love him? I didn't know him. I didn't know myself either. All I understood was that I was being offered something extraordinary, a story. Here was a fork in my road. One way led back to the safety of the dorm, the other toward romantic adventure. If I were to be a heroine in my own life story, then how could I refuse this offer? Besides, I didn't want to hurt his feelings. "Yes, I love you." Henry reached across the bikes that were between us and took my hand in his. I thought for a moment he might press it up against his hard-on, as boys usually did. But Henry simply brought my hand to his lips and kissed it tenderly like Omar Sharif, his brown eyes bottomless and lash-weighted. As he bent his head to my hand, the sunlight brought out the chestnut in his hair and revealed a bit of thinning at the crown. "We must speak of this to no one," he said, before we got on our bikes and rode back to school. The next day, I received a letter. It was written on thick, cream-colored stationery and was postmarked from Bennington College, where he worked. There was no return address. It was from Henry, speaking of his elation, our twin souls, of the lovelessness of his union with Eileen, and his conviction that we were meant to be together. "I know the world will judge us. Me, the 31-year-old predator, you, the 18-year-old victim," he wrote. But you and I are beyond time, age, or definition. Love is only available to those with the courage to grab it. Would we cave in to those whose bankrupt morals would keep two people who love each other from touching each other? Another letter arrived the next day. Our love occupies a space and time beyond my wildest imaginings. Now that this has happened, I can never return to what was. Can you? The next day, CJ, who is acting as our pigeon, is a friend in the book, passed me two letters from Henry, one in the morning, the other in the afternoon. I am born anew. You came to me in a vision. I looked up and there you were. We gazed at each other as we do, and I knew for the first time that you and I truly are. My 18-year-old self could not see how corny and cliche his letters were, how vague, histrionic, and grandiose he was. I thought this was how true love was supposed to be talked about. Anyone who would put me on that kind of pedestal deserved, at a minimum, at least a roll in the hay. I knew what to do next. I met Henry after classes at the bottom of Pine Alley, near the gatehouse, and we took off into the woods, looking for a safe place to spread out the blanket he had brought. I wondered if we would be consummating our love on Buxton Land or Clark Art Land. Henry unfolded the blanket and patted it down for me. It was more than Keith had done on the river, more consideration than Jonas had ever shown me. We disrobed and stood in front of each other. His body was lean, pale, and elegant. His cock, heavy with blood, pointed to 4 o'clock. When I was underneath him, I realized, too late, that what I actually wanted was to be with Henry in the white bed in the middle of his and Eileen's apartment. I didn't want another woodland fuck. I wanted to be Eileen, to have her relationship, her artistic alliance, and her bohemian life. It was over quickly. I remember it vaguely as being goosebumpy technical sex, but I don't remember much else about it. All I do remember was his smell, because he doused himself in cologne. And to this day, a whiff of Lagerfeld will yank me back to the spring of 1982, when I fucked the music teacher in the woods and signed myself up for my own downfall. So, two very different experiences, three very different lives, two very different accountings of similar things. I think the first question I really want to ask you, Joan, because this is your first book, and it's such a beautiful book, and it's so deftly written. And, you know, I want to know, did the book come to you after you learned about what happened to your brother? Or did you know long before that you were a writer in search of a story?
Good question. I don't think I've been asked that one. The truth is, I was a writer since I was a little girl. I don't know if you were too, Erica. Mm-hmm. The audience doesn't know this, but we share a lot in common. New York, Chicago, both 1964 babies. Yeah. Melissa Gilbert was born our year too. And I kind of thought I always write the Laura Ingalls Wilder story of Chicago. And I was going to write a love story to my family.
I was huge on Laura Ingalls Wilder as a kid.
And Michael Landon, I got to tell you, I did have a crush on him. Yeah. You went the writer's path. I think what makes you? Your parents made you in part. Yes. Mine was like, get a job, get a trade. And for me, law became my trade. So mm-hmm. I always thought I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to do this. And it was really hard to begin my legal career and write at the same time. But when I began that legal career, I was a baby lawyer when Tim called and told me what happened to him, even though all those childhood memories came back. And long story of getting through, a told criminal statute of limitations and an expired one, and then a civil lawsuit, and then a settlement that the church, I could see how the church valued Tim. It was, minimally. And his goal, Tim, let me know if I'm speaking for you, but your goal was to actually help people not have this happen to other children. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that was my only goal.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's just that there was no possible way that he could, let alone touch a child, look at a child.
So when the lawsuit didn't do much and, you know, you didn't get to call him to the square, I think we talked about telling your story. And I can tell your story, Tim. I mean, I don't know if that fits your recollection.
Yeah. Tim, when she said that to you, I mean, was that an idea that appealed to you, or did it feel dangerous and scary?
To be honest, I don't know if I really put much thought into it. I still feel compelled to trust myself as being a helper. And if what happened to me, you know, my trauma can find a way and assist somebody, young or old. I think that's probably where my brain sort of wrapped around it. Like, there's no reason to hide.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, it's shameful when you're young. I definitely went through some pretty traumatic events, my determination to destroy myself with drugs and alcohol and guns and, seedy people and then you get lucky, you find an incredible woman and you get married, you find your place in your work. Mm-hmm. And, I started loving my job again, and my two boys came along, and it ends up being a happy ending. So.
But while you're doing all that, I'm living, girl who can't let go of responsibility. I made a promise to Tim. I better learn how to tell this story. And then, of course, came that, wait, I have to learn how to write, meant I had to read, right? And long story, finally realized I couldn't tell my brother's story. I had to tell.
I tried my story. I tried to write, but I gave up within a few weeks. Joan and I were going to, I thought it was just going to be sort of just a therapeutic way of, getting through this as a family. Mm-hmm. But then, she took it in another route and I stopped. So.
And hopefully got to live your life a little.
But how long did it take you? I mean, the events and the story all happened around in the early 2000s. And so here we are in 2022. How long did it take for you to come around to telling this story, Timothy, and then for you to synthesize your own experience and also live the events of this book, which are really quite extraordinary, going to Rome and tracking this guy down. How did that work for you? Like, how did you figure out how to do it, and how long did it take to get this all on the page?
Well, Tim, how long did it take you to come forward from 13 to 32? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I was beginning my early 30s, I believe. Yeah,
and that's when your wife was pregnant with your son, and that created a lot of.
Surface some memories.
There was an urgency in my brain where I knew that there's no way I would be a good father if I didn't make sure I didn't get this guy away from kids. Mm-hmm.
So then, I probably started actively trying to write it in 2008. The lawsuit took a few years in there too. And then I realized I needed to learn to write. So then I went and got my master's of fine arts. That was 4 years of my life. And I know there's a whole theory, are MFAs good or not good? My MFA was great. I met wonderful teachers, worth every single penny I paid. Mm-hmm. And then I finished my master's thesis and people said, oh, this is ready to go, start shopping it. And that's when I realized it wasn't Joan's complete story, because Joan doesn't put a bow on something. She goes out and tries to kill people. So that's when I realized I had to go to Rome. And then it took the writing process and really, finding a publisher that would believe in telling a story of clergy sex abuse, because it doesn't sound like a sexy topic to a lot of people.
Did you
go ahead?
Read a lot of other books? Are there other books? Yeah. What is the body of literature around this, and who was inspirational to you as you were trying to figure out how to tell the story?
Well, I stayed away. I don't know if you did the same. I stayed away from a lot of direct subject, clergy mm-hmm. sex abuse, because mm-hmm. I didn't want their stories to influence my story. But I just fell in love with beautiful storytellers like Abigail Thomas, Beverly D'Onofrio, Judith Barrington, a number of wonderful Alaska writers, Ava mm-hmm. Salitis, Sherry Simpson, mm-hmm. and Ernestine Hayes. I can just give a list. Yeah. Karen, I should stop here. I finally kind of found, here's the mode I want to take. This was after Rome. I think it was Beverly D'Onofrio's Looking for Mary, when she went to Croatia on a spiritual pilgrimage for the Virgin Mary after her story of, getting pregnant in high school. And I'm like, I like this idea of using a trip as mm-hmm. a baseline for a story. So then that helped me shape and really bring 30 years, if not more, mm-hmm. 40 years of history into it. Can I ask how long your story took?
Well, the events took place in 1982, and I didn't, I lived with it as anecdote for many years until 2008. And I had written this first book. I was a memoirist. Mm-hmm. It was time to write another one. And I had always wanted to tell the story of this crazy bohemian high school I'd gone to. And I really imagined it as another humor book. And it would all be just, fun and antics and kids running around in the woods and pranking each other. And, and then there was this the small problem of that I was seduced by a teacher and kicked out right before graduation. So I didn't have a happy ending. And I was like, how am I going to write the end? I mean, I was so compartmentalized away from it. And then this friend of mine, CJ, who the book is dedicated to, called me out of the blue. It was the dawn of Facebook, and mm-hmm. people were finding each other again who had been lost to time. And CJ found me and said, Erica, do you know what happened to you in high school? And I really didn't. I really hadn't thought about it. And he made me think about it. And at the time I had two daughters who were around the ages I was when these events were happening. And that was like you, Tim, triggered by your kids. And just, I came to see that I needed to understand the story if I was going to be a good parent to these kids. I needed to understand my own story. So I started writing it in 2008 and I published it in 2021. So
that's about when I started. We both started the same
long time.
When
it was very hard to write because events were still occurring as I was writing. And then this second part of this story came up with this other man in middle age and the end of my marriage and all of that. And as I was living that very absorbing, strange thing, I realized that I was replicating what had happened to me in high school. That in my resistance to tell this true story of what had happened, I subconsciously set it up and did it all over again. And it was that affair that really forced me to confront my own damage.
Was it the ostracism you faced the second time when your marriage fell apart that made you link that, or had you already kind of figured it out?
No, I mean, yeah. I was well into the affair, and then I had the sort of no duh moment. Uh-huh. Okay. But, you know, when I looked at it, you know, older pedagogic man, inappropriate relationship for a number of reasons. And he was a writer. He was very Oedipal. My father is a writer. They, you know, big mid-century careers, male careers, all of that stuff. I mean, there were so many forces at work in that relationship. But it took a long time to process. And you can't write from a place of raw emotion.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to really compare notes with you guys about, and I mean, I found this so moving, you know, the end of your book is so beautifully done. And you tie so many strands together in such a, just a great way. You know, but one of the things that sort of left sort of open and dangling is, you know, A, your own faith, your participation in the church, in the Catholic Church, which attaches to just sort of a larger question of like, of forgiveness and closure. And I know that for me, that's something that I have really struggled with in my story. I have never gotten an apology or real acknowledgement from the school. Schools being very similar to the Catholic Church in that they're very insular. They pass the trash. They protect their own. Passing the trash is the term used for when like a priest just gets sent off to another church, or a teacher gets sent off to another school and there's no record of it, of what happened or the accusations or anything. So where are you with that? Do you think that have you found forgiveness? Both of you, I'd like to know.
You want me to go first? You want to go, Tim?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Tim's will cut to the quick, so I'll do my rambling meander, which is as right before Tim told me what happened to him, my marriage fell apart, but I was this good Catholic girl, and that wasn't supposed to happen, and it really cut me to the quick, even though it was a terrible, terrible marriage. I wish this man well, but he should not have been my husband. But that became the kind of the door for me to return to Catholicism. And I developed a very good relationship with a spiritual mentor, a lovely Jesuit priest who I've checked his record back and forth. You know, he's good. So I was going to mass. I felt I had a close connection to God, and when Tim said what happened, of course I knew all the stories in Boston, but it's like a lot of members of the laity, if it doesn't impact you directly, you kind of put up blinders. And I've noticed that in the response of some of my friends who stay in the church. But I would say, you know, a lot of the book is what's left of my faith. And I made a decision in the Vatican, a painful decision, that I can't stay. Mm-hmm. And I still long for it. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know if it's the ritual. I always say it's my relationship with the angry Jesus. I really like the guy who went in there and overturned the table. I just feel a real affinity for him. Mm-hmm. And when you're born Catholic, if you like the ritual and everything, it's really hard to go somewhere else, at least for me, because I love this. I loved that we're linked from people in the first century. I being a writer and, you know, I just like walking into a room that felt like warmth. But even since the story has come out and hearing Tim speak and, you know, some events that happen on the tour, it's even hard for me to go in for alone for those moments of silence. So I'm suffering. I love what I loved about it and really hate what I hate about it.
Yeah.
So I kind of call myself, I'm hanging on the windowsill, you know, maybe someone will grab me, bring me back in a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't think Tim wants that. And we can talk forgiveness of parents, but I don't know if you had thoughts about the church first, Tim.
I mean, forgiveness is, well, for one, you have to ask for it. Mm-hmm. It was never asked for. Mm-hmm. I did receive a letter from someone at the Passionist, you know, in regards to even the Archdiocese. But they spelt my name wrong.
Oh, God.
You know, so right there, it that's sort of like the icing on the cake when it comes to my relationship with the cult. I don't see them as anything. I don't see it as a structured religion. I see it as a criminal outfit. It's the way I looked at it. I think they're evil to the core. From, you know, I even say, you know, the devil. Mm-hmm. If there is a Satan, Satan is above, higher than the church.
Yeah.
In my mind.
Joan has a series of letters at the end of the book, and then she has your letter. And I mean, it was so wonderful to read, I have to say, you know, because it's so, you know, it's just all, it really is like, it just encapsulates all of the anger that, you know, the reader is feeling, and that finally somebody just needs to say that, you know.
It's the best part of the book. Yeah,
it was a really good.
Well, people should buy it just for that, just to hear what
it's a fantastic letter. It really is. Yeah. I mean, there's many great things, mm-hmm. but
well, yeah. that letter was written in blood. I could tell you that.
That
is extremely true, and God help him if he. I don't know if God would help him.
I know our time is kind of, I want to hear from people, but I do have a question I want to ask of all of us, which is, we talk about forgiveness of the entities. What about our parents?
Yeah, I was just actually going to ask that.
Do you want to go first, Erica?
Yeah, well, my parents, you know, my parents are both dead, and they
and
died
so are
before,
ours.
Died before the book was finished. Mm-hmm. I had a very troubled relationship with my mother my whole life. We were estranged for most of my life. And some of the reasons for that are revealed in the book, which is that she too was seduced by a teacher in college and had an enormously destructive, sexually deviant, ongoing affair with him and his wife, that totally screwed her up and made her into the damaged mother that raised me. Mm-hmm. So I do have forgiveness for her. I mean, I have deep empathy for her now, and it helps me to understand how she was able to groom me to the extent that she did for the world of predatory men. My father, I was much closer to, and I really confronted him several times. I mean, we had dinners together all the time. I mean, we were very close, and we both lived in Los Angeles towards the end of his life for about the last 30 years mm-hmm. of his life. So he was very always interested in my work and my book and supportive, but also never understood what the hell I was writing about. He didn't understand why I couldn't just get over what happened to me in high school. And he thought I should, you know. So I forgive him. I love him. They both did the best they could. They did a fairly shitty job, you know, of keeping me safe, but you know, it was the 70s.
Right.
Yeah. You,
my parents read a pretty solid draft of everything. Mm-hmm. My mother read it, and she said read it in two nights, and she loved it. And but then the one thing she said is, "I sure hope your marriage to Richard is okay." Like the most important thing she wanted to make sure is my current marriage.
Right.
And my dad, spent his last years, really, I'd say his last 10 years dying. He was very ill. And part of the reason he was dying is, or he gave up, is he realized he had repudiated his son at 16 when his son tried to tell him what happened. And he said, don't say that. And when he took cognizance of that, it slowly killed him. He read the book. He was good. The kind thing I think about him is that there was one part of the story that he disagreed with when he said something homophobic. And he said, I would never say something like that. And he did, but it was after Ellen, you know, and his heart had changed. So I really love that he changed like that. And I don't know, but losing both my parents made it really easy to forgive him, because I didn't for a long, long time, because how could I as a child know what was wrong and not them, you know? But Tim, when did you forgive him?
I know you did. All they had to do is ask.
Yeah. You know?
And did they ask?
Oh, yeah.
Shall we take, there's a question. We sort of answered that one. Linda asking, how did the family react to this, your parents and other siblings? So I don't know. Is there anything more we want to say about that?
Well, you know, I kind of make it seem in our book like it was just Tim and me, but we have five more sisters. And I'd say they were all extremely supportive of Tim. Most of us are kind of fighting people, you know. My sister's a Chicago police officer. I'm a prosecutor. Tim's a tough guy. A lot of us considered murder as a reasonable choice. I like that. I think it got to the stage in writing that people just wanted me to be done. Like I was re-injuring people, taking so long. And I know I did. I know I re-injured people, including the other boys. And I hope I can be forgiven for that.
Do you have any sense that the other boys are aware of your book or have read your book?
I know that the father and sister of one of the boys was at our book launch. And I don't think the boy would be able to read it. I think it would be really, really hard on him. I think the one that's in denial will never read it. One is dead. And then the others, I haven't heard from them yet. I don't know if Tim's heard from anyone. The people I've heard from are not Ormiche's victims, but people who, you know, call me to the side and get really quiet and say this happened to me.
Do you anticipate his death? Do you see freedom in the eventual end of this monstrous man who obviously has no soul? Do you see that as a release from something?
2 days ago, Tim, I like your answer, but 2 days ago I texted Tim because I had this, someone was trying to call me from Italy. And there is a part in the book where Tim was getting calls from Louisville, which is where the priest was removed to before Tim came forward. And I was afraid to return the call. I eventually did. And it was the owner of the Hotel Lancelot, this beautiful 93-year-old woman who's featured in the story because that hotel became a sanctuary. And she said to me, when are you coming back to Rome? And I said, oh, a couple years. And when she told me her age, I realized I have to come back sooner. So I plan on delivering a handwritten copy to that priest. I hope he lives one more year for me to do that. I wish him a good, healthy year. Tim, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but
I don't see his death being very eventful. If obviously, I'll leave it there.
Last question. Maureen is asking, Don't you think JB groomed your parents like the boys because of their deep faith? I think what she's asking was, was it the faith that allowed for the grooming, that it was the parent, that your parents' faith blinded them to what was happening?
Yeah, I think I'm interested in kind of Henry's story, if he was a repeat offender or if you were your only, you were his only person.
I don't know.
But I will say with these priests, including like looking at what they've done to the Alaska Native people, which breaks my heart.
Yeah.
That they are sociopaths and they found their way in, and for the priest to raped my brother. He needed a key, and the key was my parents, and he knew how to play them.
Yeah.
It's not complete absolution, because I think all three of us know, as soon as you fall in love with your child, when they come in your arms, that protective, you know, bear, mama bear, papa bear spirit is there. And I don't know how it disappeared.
Yeah.
But, I certainly believe he used every tool he could. I mean, the fact that he could just come over to our house when we had no money to feed all of us, you know, and eat from our table. We were children of firefighters. We weren't destitute, but there were seven of us. That's a lot of people around the table. Yeah. So, he groomed them and the other families and the, to some degrees, the teachers. Did Henry have a very charismatic personality? Because that's what Ormishay did. He had this kind of narcissistic, coming to my circle.
Yes, he was the maestro.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, I think we were talking about it before, you know, they'll find any place, boarding schools, sports teams.
Well, churches. This is the way in which, you know, yes, any situation in which children are put in the care of non-parents and kept away from the purview of their parents. So in, you know, Boy Scout troops, schools, churches, that kind of thing. And in both cases, I think in both of our books, what we're really describing is a culture that allowed for that permitted the sacrifice of children for the larger interest of the institution, which was happening in both of our cases.
Erica, I kind of see a related question where people wanted me to discuss how Ormishay reacted when confronted.
Oh, and okay.
I'll leave a lot of that to the book, but it kind of falls in with what you say is what we're talking about when you're dealing with a narcissist and a sociopath. And my good buddy Eric, who he's still on the phone as a prosecutor, they can only give what they can give. So you're not going to get the fall on your knees. You're not going to, like, you know, I get really upset when I hurt people. It hurts me to hurt people. But they don't have that ability. So it was a little, I don't know. I think I still expected more than I got, but what I came away with was a pretty good understanding that I didn't have to worry about the children of Rome.
Yeah,
because he couldn't enter their homes the way he entered ours. So that was probably, and one of answers to Tim's concern is how do we make sure children are safe?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an extraordinary. Oh, sorry, Tim, you go.
You think about it. I mean, I believe that, I mean, I don't see him as a, obviously, he's a disgusting monster. But if you really think about how intelligent it is for a pedophile to find an organization with worldwide a lot of money that can support, and you're basically God's messenger on earth families that truly believe that you are here as a man of God.
Yeah.
And he knew how to play the game.
And what a setup.
And there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't even think we've scratched the surface.
Sure. And private schools like the church are disgorging more and more stories like this of, you know, children being abused by adults in a number
of ways.
If you
think about how he reacted when he saw Joan, can you imagine how he would react if he saw me?
Yeah.
He would have ran for his life, and for a good reason. Yeah. He does.
Well, I mean, it's an extraordinary scene, and everyone should buy the book for that scene alone, which is when Joan goes and has this long conversation. It's chilling and it's fascinating and just chilling. I mean, he's a monster. Yeah. He has no idea. And it's such a useful reminder, that really, the people who do this are just essentially broken people who don't function like the rest of us.
Am I remembering this wrong from your book that you saw Henry at one point?
I've never seen him.
You've never
again.
Saw him. Okay, never I'm remembering again. Something different. All right.
Yeah, and as far as closure goes, I mean, you helped yourself to a measure of closure that I have never gotten. I have tried to. My case was this Boston Globe spotlight team, famous for doing the spotlight expose of the Catholic Church in the Boston area, did similarly an expose on private schools, private prep schools and sexual abuse. And they did a number of articles. And the one that I was featured in was when the schools punish the victim. That was the angle of that. And it was me and a couple other people who had that situation. And I thought surely I would hear from the school when that came out. Nothing. And then a group of alumni went and confronted the trustees of the school, asking for redress and acknowledgement. And the lawyers got involved, and there's a very mealy mouth letter. There is a fund set up for, psychiatric help for the victims, which of course, I've done my decades of therapy.
Right,
it's too late for me. I don't know that I've never heard from the teacher or the school.
So you didn't even get a letter with your name spelled wrong.
No, not even that. But I'm sure if I did, they would spell it wrong because everybody spells my name wrong. Yeah. Anyway, we've gone over time, so I'm going to wrap it up. But what a privilege to meet both of you, to read this book and your story. Thank you so much to Elliott Bay Books for having this, hosting this evening. It was terrific, really.
And may I put in my thanks to Erica too, and just I've been telling all my friends, and if you're on here, please buy Erica's book, especially from Elliott Bay Bookstore. It's a book company,
sure.
Great store. You will love it. I think we could even talk longer, but I know
I do too.
We all have lives, and so does the bookstore.
Everybody have a great evening.
Thank you.
Well,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Joan Knuckles-Wilson is the author of The Book of Timothy, My Brother, the Devil, and Me. Erica Schickel is the author of The Big Hurt. Special thanks to Tim Knuckles. This program was presented on January 13th, 2022 by the Elliott Bay Book Company. To find the full event and other great Seattle area talks, go to our website, kuow.org/speakers. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast and share your comments. Thank you for listening. Tune in again soon.